Hi, and welcome to another Glenn and Helen podcast. Today we're looking at two very different subjects, Israel and Middle East politics on one hand, and blog carnivals on the other. Our first guest is Israel's ambassador to the United States, Daniel Ayalon. We'll talk about Palestinian politics, Iranian nuclear weapons, and American perceptions of Israel, plus a slight mention of nude body painting.
We'll also be talking to Brad Rubenstein, one of the founders of blogcarnival.com, about the rapidly spreading phenomenon of blog carnivals and what they mean to bloggers, the blogosphere, and blog readers.
First, Ambassador Daniel Ayalon.
We're speaking to Daniel Ayalon, who is Israel's ambassador to the United States. He's been appointed in July of 2002 and has been at the forefront of developing a strong relationship between the United States and Israel. Ambassador Ayalon has worked extensively with the U.S. administration and Congress in advancing economic, political, and diplomatic relations.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure.
Well, our first question is going to be about the actress Sharon Stone. We heard that she recently visited Israel, and she has a new Middle East peace plan, we hear. She said that she would kiss just about anybody to end the Israel-Arab conflict. How has this plan worked so far?
Well, so far we really enjoyed her coming and enjoying Israel's beautiful sites and great touristic places and archaeological places. Of course, we will never shy away from anybody's plans. But, you know, peace takes two. Unfortunately, it makes only one party to make war, but it takes two for making peace, and I do not see yet a viable Palestinian party which is really interested in long-lasting peace with the genuine security and coexistence.
Mm-hmm. So has Ms. Stone headed over to the other Arab countries and tried to talk with them about this peace plan?
Not that I know of, but I will be mighty impressed if we will hear anything back from the other side.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting what's going on. We keep hearing all these reports suggesting the possibility of a civil war in Iraq, but as I look at the news reports from Gaza, it seems like there's a civil war going on right now in the Palestinian territories. Is that right?
Well, in many respects, you may say so. Well, I wouldn't go to the extent maybe of a civil war, but certainly the anarchy and lawlessness in Gaza is very rife, is very evident, which also points to the lack of leadership, unfortunately, of the Palestinian Authority and of Abu Mazen himself, which really led to the debacle and the fiasco of the Hamas elections.
What do you think we're going to see next from the Hamas government?
Well, the fact that they were participating in an election, and here it's very important to distinguish, and I think that the administration here, which we appreciate very much in its leadership position on the war against terror and trying to bring liberty and freedom to every corner of the world, understanding that not only it's the right thing from a moral point of view, but also from a practical point of view, and this is ultimately America's interest, Israel's interest, and all the free nations' interests. And also here in Washington, they understand the distinction between elections and democracy. Certainly, election can be a door to a democratic procedure, but election itself is not enough, and especially the way you conduct the elections. One of the most important principles in any democratic society is the rule of law. And the rule of law was not upheld in case of the Palestinian elections, because once you allow a terror organization with such a charter which calls for elimination of other people, with really a racist organization, they cannot participate in elections. You know, in Israel, Supreme Court barred what they termed a racist party to run in the elections. You will not find a Basque party running for elections in Spain, or a Corsican party in France, or for that matter, you will not be able to find a Nazi party participating in elections in Austria or Germany. This is against the law. And this should have been applied, the same yardstick, to the fledgling democratic, let's say, process within the Palestinian Authority. A terror organization armed to the teeth, which also is avowed to destruction of Israel, which also is totally against two-state solution, against any peaceful reconciliation or coexistence, should not have been run. This was not the case. And coupled with that, the inefficiencies of the Palestinian Authority, with all the inequities there and the, I would say, ineffectiveness and corruption of Fatah, this protest vote led to what we have now. Hamas will turn. They have not officially been sworn in to the as the new cabinet, as the new Palestinian Authority. But once they do, if they do not change, then they render themselves automatically as a terror entity and should be dealt and treated as such.
Now, but if you only accepted Palestinian political parties that renounced a policy of destruction of Israel, would there be any Palestinian political parties left to run?
Well, I hope so. You know, the Fatah, or certainly Abu Mazen, when Abu Mazen ran a year ago, actually it was January 05, to the president of the Palestinian Authority, he ran on a platform of coexistence. He ran on a platform of a peaceful dialogue. He called for the end of violence and for peaceful negotiations, which, of course, we are all share, without giving up their political aspirations, which they are entitled to, as we are entitled to our political aspirations. This is why we should meet and discuss things and come to some happy medium. But this is not the case of Hamas and few other terror organizations. By the way, Abu Mazen, when he ran to the elections over a year ago, as I mentioned, January 05, he won an overwhelming majority with 63% of the vote. So we hoped at the time that he would use this great mandate to really change things over there, change the culture of hate, and really introduce a new era. He certainly had the political power to do that. He really had the desire from the people to change things, but he did not take this responsibility. He did not really exert his authority, and he, instead of, from day one, curbing in the terror organizations, dismantling them, collecting their arms, outlawing terror organizations, he catered into them. He entered into endless negotiations with them and legitimizing them. And the result, unfortunately, is what we saw 2 months ago when a terror organization won the election.
Well, let's shift gears just a little bit. One major source of financial support for the Palestinians has been the European Union, which actually Ilka Schroeder, who's a European Union Parliament member, said was part of a proxy war against the United States and Israel. But the Europeans actually did make some positive noises about not supporting terrorism when Hamas won the election, but what are they doing now?
Well, yes, Glenn, we are quite satisfied and very encouraged from their position so far, as was expressed in the Quartet statement. The Quartet is really the underwriter of the peace process, the roadmap to peace, and the vision of President Bush of two-state solution. And the Quartet, in their meeting following this results of the Palestinian elections, said three things. That Hamas would be or could be considered a legitimate partner, but only if they follow these three prerequisites, which is namely, first of all, recognizing Israel's right to exist, and I might add, as a Jewish state. Secondly, if they renounce terror, dismantle terror infrastructure, and fight terror on a sustainable basis. And thirdly, if they recognize all the previous agreements between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. If this is the case, Hamas is no longer Hamas. If they don't change, they will have to get changed, hopefully by the people, and we should help that by not legitimizing them, by isolating them politically, and by not helping them economically. Now, Helen, you asked how much the European aid is. It's quite substantial. I would say it's pretty much a third of the Palestinian budget. So it's very important. And if we stop this financial means to the Hamas government, without punishing the Palestinian people, and we can do that. I think this will make the point that terror does not pay, and this may expedite the changeover in the Palestinian Authority, because one of two things must happen. Either the Hamas change its ideology as contact and stop terrorism, or they will have to be changed by the people. There is no happy medium here, unfortunately, and there are too many important things on the table not to deal with it. So it is very important for the entire international community to show a unity of purpose and also a unity of position. So far, we have the Europeans, I believe, together with the United States, with Israel. We hope that other countries like Russia and Arab countries as well will follow suit, because it's certainly not a not an interest of Arab countries to have an Iran-type state developing in the heart of the Middle East.
Well, let's actually shift gears to Iran, since we do have an Iran-type state there already, and one that is aggressively pursuing nuclear weapons. I've noticed a lot of Americans actually seem to hope that Israel will take care of the problem for us, and I feel that's a little bit of wishful thinking on their part. What's Israel's position on Iranian nuclear weapons, and what can we expect?
Well, thank you, Glenn. I would say Israel's position is very clear. We are not in the lead. Iran is not an Israeli problem, or not just an Israeli problem. It's a main problem for the entire international community. And I think that Secretary Rice was very right to say that this is the top or the most pressing issue on the agenda. I might add that the danger from Iran is the gravest, by all means, the gravest danger that the international community faced. It's the greatest danger to peace and security for the world since World War II, since the Nazi regime. Now, having said that, it's not only Israel that cannot live with a nuclear Iran. It's basically all its neighbors, and also European countries and much beyond. A nuclear Iran will be devastating to the free flow of oil from the Middle East. They can continue with much more bold terror activities with impunity, let alone equip terror organizations like Al-Qaeda or even Hamas or Hezbollah or anywhere in the world with weapons of mass destruction, and the world will not be safe. So they must be stopped. I think there is a growing realization and recognition that they must be stopped. Secondly, can they be stopped? Absolutely yes. And hopefully with political means. I don't think that the political process and the diplomatic process has exhausted itself yet. And here we will need again a unity of purpose and a unity of position by the entire international position community. And the sooner they do it, the better, because we are here on really a very strict timeline. As we deliberate, as we talk, whether it's in the UN or whether it's in Vienna with the IAEA, Iranians keep working relentlessly. And they may cross the point of no return by the end of 06. Now, the point of no return, as I see it, is not necessarily when they already have a weaponized, warhead with nuclear. A point of no return when Iran becomes sufficiently independent in continuing their program without any help from the outside. So far, they have been converting uranium in a very important stage, which turns a raw uranium, the yellow cake, into a gas, which is called the UF6. The next stage is taking this gas and turning it into highly enriched uranium. This is what they are concentrating now on, R&D with the centrifuges. And once they master this process, this is a point of no return. They will not need anybody, and on their own, they can make the bomb. It may take them 2 years, 3 years. It's beside the point. You cannot stop them. Now is the time to stop them, and hopefully they will understand that there is a big price for them to pay if they are isolated politically, if there will be some economic measures, which I believe they cannot withstand, the Iraqi the Iranian economy, and also if there is an imposition by the Security Council, hopefully, of a very airtight control regime that the Iranians will have to agree to or suffer the consequences.
It doesn't sound like you're suggesting there's much likelihood of another OSIRAC-type mission, though.
Well, you know, these things are not being discussed, not even in the most respected blogs as yours. And they're not discussed in any type of media. But all I can say is that if we do not reach, and I'm talking about the international community, if it doesn't reach any solution, political solution, on an expeditious manner, it certainly narrows down the options for the future.
Well, let's move the focus to the United States. I think Helen has a few questions about Israel and the United States.
Yeah, talking about supporting Israel, according to some of the polls that I've read on the web, like abcnews.com, sympathy for Israel peaks at around 64% for Republicans, but it's down to about 34% among Democrats. Why is there so much more support for Israel among the Republicans, and do you think why do you think Democrats are less likely to support Israel?
Well, it's important for us, you know, to reach and transcend the aisle, and we very much work on a bipartisan support. Here in Congress, I can tell you that I meet both Democrat and Republican members of Congress in the House and in the Senate, and many of them tell me that they do not agree with each other on any single issue except Israel. You know, in the case of Israel, they say there are no Republicans, no Democrats, only Americans. And I would like to have the same kind of sentiment by the entire American public, since Israel is really a staunch ally of the United States, and the U.S. is certainly our best friend and ally. We go together many, many years. We share the same values. We have the common interests. We also, unfortunately, are facing the same threats, and we are being attacked by terror, not because of our policies, not because of what we do, but because of who we are, what we represent. And we help each other on many, many fronts. Just today, this week, we had a very important conference in Israel of Homeland Security where American officials from all across this land, on the federal, on the state, and then on the county level, sat with the Israeli experts to exchange views, share know-how and methods and of operations. And we will continue with that. We work together on so many issues, military, strategic, economy. I'm very proud to say that Israel is the largest trading partner of the United States in the Middle East. You know, we buy, little small Israel buys a third of all American services and goods which are sold in the Middle East. And our bilateral trade reached last year $20 billion. There are many cultural ties, and I really feel a great bond between our two countries, and I'm sure this will continue and get strengthened. You mentioned, Helen, 64%. Mm-hmm. The latest polls I see show 68% of American support, and we hope it will continue to grow. By the way, the other way around, if you take polls in Israel, mm-hmm, about support of the United States and its people, you would find an amazing 90-95% of Israelis who just admire the United States and support it.
You know, it's funny. I think a lot of Americans don't have a very clear idea of what life's actually like in Israel. And we have a friend who's visiting there now, and a lot of people were worried that it was really dangerous. And every once in a while, I link on my blog to some photos that an Israeli photographer named Verti posts on his blog of the Love Parade and the beaches and such. And people are always surprised. I don't know what they expected to see, but not such a normal-looking life. Do you think that's a widespread perception?
I hope not, Glenn, and I hope with time this really dissipates and people understand more the realities. I would say the hard evidence, the details, the data shows that statistically you are safer in Israel than almost any other place in the world. You are safer there than you are in New York City, for instance. And that goes anywhere, everywhere there. I think Israel is a great country to visit. if you have religious background, inspirational background, you can go to the mountain of Galilee to walk in the footsteps of Jesus in Nazareth and Sfat, and of course Jerusalem and Jordan River, the baptism site, and Caesarea. We have beautiful long beaches along the Mediterranean. We have the most beautiful scuba diving on the Sea of Eilat. And of course we have craters, you know, a very small scale, but you know, like the canyon, the Grand Canyon type in the Negev. So there are many, many beautiful things to see, and you also will find Israelis very hospitable, and especially to Americans.
Sounds great. I'd like to go visit myself.
Well, first of all, you and Glenn have an official invitation. And please let us know whenever your time allows. You'll be most welcome there, and you will find many, many friends there.
Well, I certainly liked the photos of the body painting at the Boumanbela Festival, but I don't know whether Helen would approve or not.
Well, you know, we have, you'll see, the culture in Israel is, and art in Israel is very thriving and growing all the time. You know, we have many, many great festivals, movie festivals and jazz festivals and even religious festivals and Hasidic type festivals and song and dance and jazz, whatever you have, you can find in Israel. And we have this old, old amphitheater in Caesarea, in Old Roman, and also in Jerusalem, the old, what we call the old Sultan Valley, which are very great for concerts. And many concerts were held there. Trying to remember now the big names that were there, but there were quite big names there. Maybe it comes to me. But also in terms of science and technology, you know, we are very strong on nanotechnology, on biotechnology, and many, many things.
Well, you know, one interesting statistic I saw was that only 34% of American Jews feel any emotional attachment to Israel. And I don't know if that's right, but do you think that the American Jewish community is as supportive of Israel as it was 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, I think by and large it's supportive, and especially at times of straits or at times of crisis, we do see that. But I am particularly encouraged by the great support we get from the Christian community here. And the Christian community is, the evangelical in particular, they are visiting Israel, they are supporting Israel. Now there is an initiative by some Christians to lease land in near the Sea of Galilee, near Tiberias, to build a huge resort for pilgrims, for Christian pilgrims that can come there and study or just tour and enjoy. And we, the Israeli government, of course, very much encourages that as well.
Well, that's interesting, because I wonder if it's because, you know, more evangelical types live here in the South. More people here in the South are sympathetic to Israel. In fact, 50% of Southerners have sympathy for Israel, which is about 11 points higher than the rest of the country. So I think that's sort of an interesting statistic.
Mm-hmm. Well, that could very well be, that could be a reason why in the South maybe the our numbers are higher, but we certainly appreciate that. We reach out to them, and I think that this bond between us also is based on really Judeo-Christian, you know, principles and values.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much to both of you. And again, Glenn and Helen, I would like to repeat our invitation. You'll be most welcome anytime.
Thank you. We'd love to come.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there's a little bit of a common thread here. In the last segment, we did manage to talk about body painting festivals, and now we're about to talk about blog carnivals.
I don't know why you think I'd mind the idea of naked women having their bodies painted. I mean, I might try it myself.
Maybe we will have to go.
Well, how about in the meantime we talk to Brad Rubenstein, who's quite the festive guy himself. He's here to talk about blog carnivals and spontaneous organization in the blogosphere.
It's not body painting, but hey.
That'll be for when we start video podcasts.
Well, we've been hanging out with our cousin Brad Rubenstein, who does blogcarnival.com. And after spending a lot of time at Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge and unfortunately missing Dollywood, which isn't open right now, we decided what better way to round out the weekend than to do a podcast interview.
And we could do it right here in our studio. That makes it a lot easier. And
yeah.
Actually, we just couldn't find a guest for this week. Wasn't that it?
Well, anyway, he's got blogcarnival.com, which is like your one-stop shopping place for blog carnivals. You can find them, you can research them, you can announce them, and, well, there's probably other stuff you can do with them, too, and some of it may even be legal in Tennessee. But I'm going to ask him to talk a little about blogcarnival.com and about blog carnivals in general, because this is this big subterranean phenomenon that I think he's got a better big picture view of than anybody else. So start out, Brad. Tell us how you got interested in blog carnivals and how you wound up setting up blogcarnival.com.
Well, I think my main claim to fame has got to be that I've read more blog carnivals than anyone on the planet. I think that I have a pretty good idea of what's going on out there right now with respect to blog carnivals. There are certainly a lot of different kinds of them. There are really serious ones and really silly ones.
What are the silly ones?
The silly ones? Yeah. Well, let's see. I really like the Carnival of Bauer, which is about the reality TV series. And there is the Carnival of Knitting is really one of my favorites. Sugar High Friday is a food carnival all about desserts and sweets. So all over the map. There are also really serious ones like Grand Rounds about medicine, and there's a legal carnival called Blog Review. But my favorite ones are the more out there, more silly ones.
Oh, you know, actually, some people listening may not know what a blog carnival is. And so can you help those poor benighted souls by telling them, what they find if they go to their first blog carnival? Will they be asked to disrobe?
Some of them probably yes, but you could start with some of the more serene carnivals. They're all different kinds. The thing that all carnivals have in common is that they come out periodically like a magazine. Someone organizes them. A lot of bloggers find things on a certain topic, like knitting, and all those knitting bloggers submit their posts to the carnival organizer. And then on a regular basis, like once a week or once a month or whenever the organizer feels like it, the organizer will publish a carnival edition on their blog, and that'll be edition 36 of the Carnival of Knitting, and then they'll provide links to all the different submissions that they've received. The knitters love it because they get lots of traffic, and the readers love it because out of millions and millions of blogs, it's kind of hard to find those really special articles about how to make socks.
Yeah, I really like the carnivals as sort of an entry point to an area. Like, I like the Blog Mela, which is what the Indian bloggers put together, because it really gives me sort of an overview of lots of stuff that Indian bloggers are interested in that it'd be pretty hard to find out any other way.
Some of the most interesting carnivals to me are the geographically centered carnivals. Some of them are organized around topic, but many of them are just people from a particular location. There's the Virginia Blog Carnival. There's a couple Indian blog carnivals. One is dedicated to science, actually, and that's called the Sion Melt, is the Indian Scientists Carnival. There's also British bloggers, French bloggers. There's the blog carnival of German-American relations. A lot of these are geographically based, and some of them have a political flavor and some don't.
What about just knowledge-based ones? Like, say you're a mom or dad who want to homeschool. You can go and you can find out about the Carnival of Homeschooling, I imagine.
There's a Carnival of Homeschooling. There's carnivals related to different things that parents go through. There are carnivals related to – there's a blog carnival related to cancer, for example, which is not posts of doctors but posts of patients and their experiences.
So anything that's happened to you in life or that you've thought about, there's some kind of carnival to help you understand it more.
Well, we have about 200 of them running at through Blog Carnival right now. Blog Carnival is sort of the central point where people go to find out where all the different carnivals in the blogosphere are happening. We don't actually host them, but we certainly know where they all are.
Yeah, that's actually the great thing because, you know, a blog carnival is sort of like a floating crap game. You've got to know where to go to pick up the next edition, and I used to put links on my blog to tell people where carnivals were, but that kind of got out of hand when we went from 2 or 3 carnivals to 2 or 300, and even people who want to participate in the carnivals, if you miss an email or miss a blog post, it's kind of hard to catch up sometimes.
Yeah, and that's why we started Blog Carnival in the first place. When we start out, my colleague Steve Dameron in California and I'm in New York, we were avid readers of these carnivals, especially the food carnivals, which we love. And the main problem was we couldn't find out where they were happening and how they were happening. And after a while, like you said, you didn't have links to all of them. So we decided, you know, to make the links ourselves.
So my failure is the blogosphere's triumph. Hooray!
Yeah, I'll say.
Well, it really is, to me, kind of an interesting sort of bigger picture story that you have all this spontaneous self-organization. I mean, people don't wait for some big shot to tell them to have a carnival on a topic. Somebody just starts one and away it goes.
Well, you know, there were blog carnivals going around before we came on the scene. I think the first one was Carnival of the Vanities, and that started around 2002, late 2002. People originally were doing it by sending their friends emails and putting things on their blogs, mentioning and advertising that these carnivals were happening and calling for submissions. And whoever happened to stumble upon those posts got to play. And if you missed it, then you missed out.
So there's like a carnival of cats and a carnival of comedy. And there's a... There are military blog carnivals, and there's the Carnival of the Mobilists about cell phones and mobile computing, and what the Carnival of the Walkers, is that about shoes, or what is that?
There are Carnivals of the Walkers, Carnivals of the Runners, there's a Triathletes Carnival, there's the Carnival of the NFL, the Carnival of the NHL, lots of sports carnivals, lots of pets carnivals, there's a Bird Watchers Carnival, and dogs, cats. There's a carnival for scientists that are interested in invertebrates, insects, and slugs and things.
Is that the Carnival
pictures.
Of the Slimy?
It's called the Circus of the Spineless.
That was close.
Yeah, that's all these carnivals have great little logos. You can go to the site and see they're very colorful. You know, one of the main things about these carnivals that attracts people is that they're just fun.
And how do people submit to you? I mean, what do they do to get to you to...
Well, in the olden days, people would just send, they would figure out who was hosting the next edition of a carnival, and they'd send them email. Nowadays, different ways of submitting things, but blogcarnival.com provides a submission form, the advantage of which is that you can do your submissions through our site, and we'll do the work of finding out where it should go and when, and get the submissions to the right carnival host.
So what's in it for you? Fame? Fortune? The cover of Sports Illustrated?
Well, I'll tell you, the main thing is that we get to read every carnival on the planet. We don't read them all in detail, but they really are a great way to learn about new blogs, and they're a great way to see what people are talking about on any particular topic.
Yeah, I find it a good way to find new blogs, and one of the pieces of advice that I give to new bloggers who are sort of looking to build an audience is that they submit things to the carnivals, that's a good way to get noticed and get some readers and kind of get your name out there.
One of the things that I think most bloggers want is more traffic, and plugging into a community of people who are all interested in a topic that you're already writing about is a great way to get those people to read things on your site. After you've submitted some posts to a carnival and people know your name, a great thing to do is to host a carnival and get people to send their submissions to you. You'll be linking to their site. You'll find out more about what they're writing about, and it's often a good way to get ideas yourself.
So do you have any advice for people who are organizing carnivals or thinking of hosting one or thinking of starting one?
Well, the first step is obviously to see what carnivals are out there. If you go through the list of carnivals at Blog Carnival, it's pretty long, and there are lots of different things, but there's certainly room for lots more carnivals out there. The main thing is that you want to get a community of people together to share the work of putting on the carnival. People are doing this for fun, and so if you find yourself putting out a magazine by yourself every week on the topic that you're passionate about, it can be a lot of work. And if you really want a carnival that's going to have a good life and come up with interesting stuff, the main rule is to get lots of people involved.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. I've only hosted one carnival myself. It was a digital camera carnival, but after I was done doing it, I thought, you know, I'd hate to have to do this every week.
But you sure probably knew a lot about cameras and bloggers at the end.
Yeah, it pulls a lot of stuff together. So say you're actually submitting to a blog carnival. Is there sort of an ideal platonic form for a carnival submission?
Well, yes, there is, and it's pretty simple. The main thing that carnival hosts want is just the link to your article. And if they want to find out more about what you're submitting, they'll just go read what you posted. The basic idea is that you're going to post articles on your own blog about whatever you're going to, whatever you like to write about. And getting the links to those articles to the carnival host is the main thing. And we have a form at blogcarnival.com that makes that easy.
Any final words of wisdom for bloggers and carnival hosts out there?
Well, I would say the main thing is that there's plenty of room for more carnivals, and I love reading them, so keep them coming, and we'll get a whole bunch of new ones up real soon.
Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
That's really good advice.
Well, I hope that people enjoyed this show, though I think you may have left them looking forward to the Naked Body Painting video podcast.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. In fact, I'm back there charging up the video camera as we speak.
Well, just keep waiting, folks. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed this. We'll be back with another podcast whenever we feel like it. You can check for updates at our blogs, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com, or you can subscribe via iTunes, we like that, or any of the other podcast subscription services. In the meantime, take care, have fun on the internet, and we'll be back.
Talk to you next time.